Fairy tales are not what they used to be. I don't know if you've noticed this or not. Fairy tales are not what they used to be. You see, when I was growing up, the tale of the three little pigs, in that tale, the wolf ate the pig who made his house out of straw, and he ate the pig who made his house out of sticks. These days, though, the modern version has those two little pigs escaping to the house of bricks and surviving. It's the same with Little Red Riding Hood. When I was growing up, Grandma got eaten by the wolf, swallowed her whole. But in the modern version, Grandma gets locked in the closet. Now, why is it that it's like this? Well, the answer came to me in a podcast I was listening to recently. The podcast is called This Cultural Moment. James and Tamara got me onto it, and I think it's one of the top five best things on the internet today, if you want to write it down. This Cultural Moment. It's a conversation between a US pastor and an Aussie pastor about culture, about this cultural moment. And in episode five, they point out that modern Western secularism has insulated people from any kind of psychological harm. We've insulated people from any kind of psychological harm. Now, the reason for this is that because if there's no meaning to life, and that's what atheism has to declare, right? If we're an accident, there's no meaning to life, all right? Then happiness becomes our highest value. Feeling good in the moment. As the saying goes, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. And the reason we've changed the fairy tales is because we no longer want to warn children that life is hard, and that's what fairy tales were originally designed to do. We now want to insulate our children from life's hardships. Now, the big problem with this, as psychologists and sociologists point out, is that of all the worldviews today, like worldviews like Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, of all the worldviews today, the Western secular worldview is the least equipped to prepare people for dealing with pain and suffering. The Western secular worldview is the least equipped to prepare people to deal with pain and suffering. And friends, this is the worldview we've been raised in. Right? Our society tells us that pain and suffering is at best an interruption to our happiness, or at worst, a permanent obstacle to our happiness. And so when we in the West come up against real suffering in life, Christians included, many of us have no idea what to do. A lot of us actually end up putting life on hold because we've bought that lie that there will be no happiness and therefore there is no meaning to life until this season of suffering passes. And this is why our sermon series this term is so important. Friends, if you miss a week of church or a week of Bible study, you'll be missing one of the most profound lessons the Bible can give us on how to handle suffering. Right? Each week, we're going to be looking at a different lesson on how you and I can best handle suffering. And it's my prayer that these lessons will have as profound an impact on you as they have had on me as I was preparing the Bible studies for it this term. It is an enormous, awesome series. And for this week, the lesson we've got this week, there's 4 points I have, and you can see that on the inside of your sermon outline. Now, our first 2 points are a bit shorter. They're looking at two specific issues that Joseph has to deal with in this passage, and they are how Joseph handles power and how Joseph handles temptation. But then, in point three, we're going to get to the real heart of this passage, and that is how Joseph handles hardship. That's what this passage is investigating, how Joseph handles hardship. And then we're going to conclude by looking at how Joseph is able to handle this hardship. All right, now, goal in this is to figure out what it is that Joseph knew that our modern Western society has forgotten. What is it that Joseph knew that meant he didn't put his life on hold during his period of suffering? He actually thrived. That's what we see in this passage. We see Joseph thriving. Because if we can figure this out, how Joseph handled power, how Joseph handled temptation, how Joseph handled hardship, and how Joseph was able to handle hardship, then we too will be able, hopefully, to thrive during our seasons of suffering. And is that not something we all want? To be able to thrive. So let's begin. And Genesis 39 brings us back to our hero, Joseph. So we had a bit of an interlude last week with Judah, We're back with Joseph, and we're told that Joseph was sold to an Egyptian by the name of Potiphar in verse 1, and he was the captain of the guard. Now, we believe captain of the guard was perhaps one of the, probably, if not the highest rank, one of the highest ranks, if not the highest rank in the ancient world. And Joseph so distinguishes himself to Potiphar that Potiphar soon makes him, promotes him to chief of his household. Right? So get this, even though Joseph is a slave, he is promoted to being basically CEO of the household of one of the most important people in the most powerful nation on earth. And what we see is Joseph using that position to bless the household of Potiphar. That's what verses 5 and 6 tell us. His household was blessed when Joseph was in charge. Sadly, we can't say the same for Potiphar's wife. Have a look at verse 7. Now, after a while, his master's wife took notice of Joseph and said to him, "Come to bed with me." Now, that little exclamation point at the end of that verse there, that doesn't mean she's yelling. That's to indicate that this is a command. Now, it's only two words in the Hebrew, but she is basically saying to her slave, "Hey, sex now. Sex now." That's what she's saying. And before we say, well, gosh, typical women, let's remember that 95% of these kinds of circumstances are men demanding sex of female subordinates. And usually females do not have the strength to escape like Joseph did. But what we learn here is that this is a picture of a woman who has been twisted and corrupted by her power. This is how power can twist and corrupt a person. She's the wife of one of the most prominent people in her society, and that power she's been cooked in has led her to take whatever she wants. Now, in the new Lion King movie, there's a line, L-I-N-E, delivered by the dulcet tones of James Earl Jones, and he says, "While others search for what they can take in life, a true king searches for what he can give." Now, don't you love it when Hollywood paraphrases Jesus, paraphrases the Bible? This is Jesus in Mark 10:42. Jesus called them together and said, "You know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant." And that's what Joseph did, all right? Where Potiphar's wife used her power to take, Joseph used his power to give. And in doing so, he preempts the true king. "For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many." Now, friends, we all have power of some form in our world, in our life. Right, even as a slave, Joseph had his business skills. And he used those skills to bless others. And it's the same with us. You see, whether you're a doctor or a nurse, whether you're a politician or you're the person who cleans the table at the local food court, we all have some form of power. And the question this little section asks us is, are we going to use that power to take, like Potiphar's wife, or are we going to use that power to give? Like Joseph. So that's how Joseph handles power. Next, we see how Joseph handles temptation. You see, the second time we read of Potiphar's wife demanding that Joseph sleep with her, we read this in verse 12. Where is it? "But he left his cloak in her hand and ran out of the house." He ran out of the house. Now, this is probably what inspired the Apostle Paul in 2 Corinthians 6:18 to say, "Flee from sexual immorality." Right, that's what Joseph is doing. He is fleeing. Right? We are not to flirt with sexual immorality. We're not to say things like, "Oh, look, everyone does it." We're not to say things like, "Oh, it's not really hurting anyone, is it?" We're not to say things like, "How far am I allowed to go?" Right, that's flirting with sexual immorality. To flee something is to run in the exact opposite direction. And there are two reasons why Joseph flees here. The first is, he knows that such an encounter is just not worth it. Have a look at verse 9. No one is greater in this house than I am. My master has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. You see, Joseph knows that the short-term pleasure this might bring will result in long-term pain. Now, modern society teaches the opposite. It says, what's the harm in sex outside of marriage? Well, modern science has actually told us the harm. See, modern science has told us that there are certain endorphins released in the brain during sexual activity, and those endorphins are specifically designed for pair bonding. Right? So this is not the Bible talking, this is modern science talking here. There are endorphins released that are specifically designed for pair bonding, and what that means is that one of the purposes for sex is to draw two people together in deep life commitment. Deep life commitment. And so if we sleep with someone whom we haven't made a deep life commitment to, and that's marriage, okay, then we're actually misusing sex. You see, sex before marriage, pornography, prostitution, adultery, they are all forms of misusing sex. And as we know, when we misuse something, we damage it. Now, how do we damage sex, you might ask? Well, friends, when we misuse sex, we actually weaken our ability to do deep life commitment. Right? If we have reduced sex to nothing more than a physical encounter, which is what sex is without that deep life commitment, then we have weakened our ability to do deep life commitment. That means we've weakened our ability to build a strong marriage. You've got to ask yourself, is it worth it to actually have struggles in building a strong marriage for the rest of your life? All right, and that is the first reason Joseph flees sexual immorality. It's not worth it. The second reason is also in verse 9. Have a look right down the end. How then could I do such a wicked thing and sin against God? Now, if we're trying to fight against these kinds of sinful desires, please know that the way to defeat sin long term is not to suppress our desires. Right, hard work and self-control are only ever a short-term solution. They're a good solution, but they are a short-term solution. The reason being that when we're tired or hungry or stressed or lonely, we won't have the strength to be able to suppress it then, and that's when Satan pounces. The only way to defeat temptation long-term is to replace our sinful desires with a greater desire for God. Right, the reason Joseph was able to handle Potiphar's wife's continued advances all the time, day after day, was because it's not because he'd suppressed his desires, it's because he'd reordered them. His desire for God outweighed his desire for this kind of sexual pleasure. Now, how did he do that? How do we do that? Well, it was Freud who said that our spiritual longings are nothing more than frustrated sexual longings. He said our spiritual longings, longings for God, are nothing more than frustrated sexual longings. The Bible says it's actually the opposite. Right? You see, our sexual longings come from a desire for someone to find us beautiful, to find us desirable, to find us lovely, and to give themselves to us. Right? This is one of the main drivers in sex. If this person gives themselves to me, then I know I'm worth it. But friends, do you understand that we have that in the gospel? Jesus said, I find you so beautiful, so desirable, so lovable that I am willing to give myself to you. And folks, when we realize that, all right, when we realize that I am Jesus' ultimate treasure, that he gave himself to me in deep life commitment. That's what the cross is for Jesus, deep life commitment. Then he actually becomes the chief of all our desires. So may we continue to remind ourselves of this deep life commitment that Jesus gave to us, so that resisting temptation won't be a matter of self-control, it'll be a matter of our delight. We will delight to do so. So, we've seen how Joseph handles power, we've seen how Joseph handles temptation. The rubber hits the road for this passage, though, in how Joseph handles hardship. You see, in this one chapter, Joseph goes from being a slave, which is bad enough, to being put in jail, to be rotting in a dungeon somewhere. And what makes this extra hard is that Joseph does everything right in this chapter. Okay, there's no arrogance, there's no insensitivity, there's no cultural subversion in this chapter like we saw in Genesis 37. Joseph does everything right, but he gets chucked in jail anyway. And one of the main questions this passage asks us is, how would we react in this situation? How would we react if we did everything right, but we got punished horribly for our troubles? Like, what would we do if we were in Joseph's position? Would we get angry? Would we rage against God? You know, say, why on earth, God? I'm one of your children. You're supposed to look after me. Or would we become despondent? We'd sit in the dust and mope. You know, would our life go on hold until that period of suffering was over? Now, what do I mean by that? I knew a couple years and years ago, they tried for 8 years before they actually had kids. 8 years. Now, after the third year, I would say to the husband, how are you going? His response would be, oh, not good. We're still not pregnant. It was like 5 years he said that to me. It was as though everything else in his life took a back row seat to his suffering. Right? It was as though everything in life was on hold until they finally got what they wanted, finally got pregnant. His suffering had become a permanent blocker to any happiness he was going to enjoy in life. Now look, friends, I'm not saying we should ignore suffering or try and pretend it's not there. We're not actually told about Joseph's emotional state in this passage, but we can be certain he was deeply upset. Right? He's not a robot. I guarantee you, he was praying every night, how long, O Lord? See, the Bible doesn't say rejoice in our hardships, it says lament them. Right? If you're taking notes, write that down. The Bible says lament hardships. But the thing that is striking, that strikes me the most about this chapter is that Joseph didn't let his suffering own him. See, if we allow our lamenting to make us think that our happiness and therefore our life is on hold until that suffering passes, then we've allowed that suffering to own us. And if there's one thing we can say about Joseph in this chapter, it is that he did not let his situation own him. He didn't simply sit in the dust awaiting release. He got on with his job. He got on with life. He got on with using the skills that God had blessed him with to serve others. In fact, Joseph did so well. I mean, this is the thing that just blows me away. He did so well that whoever came into contact with Joseph automatically put him in charge. Now, who do you put in charge? You don't put your professional miseries in charge, do you? You don't put people in charge who are owned by their suffering. You put people in charge who own their suffering, who own their hardships. And the reason Joseph owned his hardships is because he understood what suffering actually is. Right, friends, suffering is not a permanent blocker to happiness or meaning in life. Please do not buy into that lie. Right, suffering is how God helps us grow in character and resilience. If you only write one thing down tonight, that's what you write down. Suffering is how we grow in character and resilience. Right, that's what fairy tales are supposed to do. Parents told their kids fairy tales back in the day to teach them that life will bring hardships, like big bad wolves. But on top of that, it is to teach them how to handle those hardships. Don't cut corners, take your time to make your house out of bricks. Or, not everyone who seems sweet and gentle is actually sweet and gentle, like the Red Riding Hood. Right, but here's the thing, friends, we have something even better than fairy tales to teach us that. It's called God's Word. In particular, it's called the Joseph narratives. All right, God put Joseph through 12 years of slavery and prison to transform him into one of the greatest servant leaders our world has ever known. And so the big question this passage asks us is, Are we going to let our seasons of suffering handle us, own us? Or are we going to handle them? Because there's people in this church who are really suffering right now. Right, there are people here in our church dealing with debilitating illnesses or looking after loved ones who are dealing with debilitating illnesses. There are people in our church dealing with deep emotional issues or trying to help their kids through deep emotional issues. There are people suffering the loss of loved ones. There are people dealing with painful marriage problems. There are people dealing with serious financial problems or problems at work. And friends, we can either let these seasons of suffering and hardship handle us, own us, or we can handle them. We can do what Joseph did. Yes, lament, but while we're lamenting, what do? We get on with life. We work to the best of our abilities and we'll actually thrive. We can thrive through our moments of suffering, our seasons of suffering. So that just leaves one final question. How do we do this? How are we able to do this? How was Joseph able to handle his moments and periods of suffering? How can we see suffering as character building and resilience building rather than a permanent blocker to happiness and meaning? Well, we see it with a little phrase that bookends this chapter. It's at the beginning and the end. So if you flick back to verse 2, we see it in verse 2, the Lord was with Joseph so that he prospered. And then down in verse 21, the Lord was with him. While Joseph was in prison, the Lord was with him. Friends, the overarching theme to this whole sermon series is that just because God is silent doesn't mean God is absent. Just because God is silent doesn't mean God is absent. In fact, as this very passage highlights, it's when God seems the most hidden to us that he's often working the hardest for us. Now, we know this because we have a perspective on Joseph that Joseph didn't have. Not only do we have verse 2 and verse 21, but we also know that if Potiphar's wife hadn't done what she did, then Joseph would never have met the king's cupbearer in Genesis 40, next week's passage. Joseph would never have been promoted to second in the kingdom, Genesis 41, in 2 weeks' time. And Joseph would never have been able to save Egypt and his family from famine in Genesis 42 and following. But here's the thing, right? Joseph didn't have that perspective. His story hadn't been written when he was going through it. And it's the same with us. Our story hasn't been written yet, has it? So how are we going to be able to handle this hardship? Well, we do what Joseph did. And that is to remind ourselves that even though we don't see how God is using this hardship, Joseph couldn't see how God was using his hardship, but he trusted that God was still with him. Joseph knew that God's silence did not mean God's absence. Now, Christians have an even better reason to believe this than Joseph did. And that is because God was absent once on that very first Good Friday. My God, why have you forsaken me? Friends, can you imagine what it would have been like for Jesus to have the Father absent? When Deb was 12, she went on a family holiday in New Zealand. It was a driving holiday. They hired a camper van, drove up and down the islands. And during one of the petrol stops, everyone went into the toilet. They got back in the car. Deb's dad got back in the car and said, "All right, is everyone here?" And Deb's brother and sister, they were 8 and 10 at the time, too young to know anything, and they were, you know, very distracted. They said, "Yep, we're all good." And so they took off down the road, and Deb stepped out of the toilet to see her family driving off. And she ran for about 100 metres, screaming for them to stop, and they didn't. They just went over the hill. And so this little 12-year-old girl, no mobile phone, no money, foreign country, no idea how to look after herself, all she could do was sit down on the side of the road and cry. And she cried for about 20 minutes. That's how long it took for them to realize their eldest was not there, and they turned around and came back. Imagine how that would feel. Now, we might say, oh, but Jesus was only, he was only absent from God for 6 hours on the cross. It was only 6 hours. But friends, what we're failing to take into account is that time works differently for an eternal being. Right, Jesus learnt firsthand that day what it meant for God to be absent. But the reason he did that was so that you and I never have to know that. In fact, we now know that when it feels like God is absent, he's actually working the hardest to transform us into the most beautiful and the most resilient creatures we can be. So friends, when hardships come, and they're going to come, all right? It's a guarantee. When hardships come, please don't buy the lie of modern Western secularism. Please don't think that our happiness and our meaning are on hold. Yes, lament hardship, but don't wallow in bed all day doing so. Instead, get up every day and go about your job, go about your life, go about what you do, and do it to the best of your abilities, all right? We get up and we worship the Lord to the best of our abilities. We love our spouse to the best of our abilities. We raise our kids in righteousness to the best of our abilities. We do our work and serve the community, whether it's in our job or volunteerism, to the best of our abilities, and we serve our church to the best of our abilities. And as we do that, we pray that God will bless us like he blessed Joseph, so that everyone who comes across us will be impressed at how we don't get handled by hardship. We handle it ourselves.